Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Monday, April 20th, and we're diving deep today with our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition. I'm Maya, and alongside me as always is Alex.
And good to be here, Maya. You've got a lot to unpack because the market feels, well, it feels like these trends are finally starting to coalesce. Like minerals in a supersaturated solution, distinct forces are beginning to crystallize into something entirely new.
Always with the analogies, Alex. All right, let's ground things. First up, macroeconomics. Are we really about to see a fundamental shift in tax policies and infrastructure spending? And what does that mean for your portfolio?
The data tells a story and the numbers are startling. We're talking potentially trillions in redirected investment. But it's not just about the money, it's about the signal it sends.
Speaking of signals, AI adoption is accelerating, but is it translating into actual productivity gains or just hype? And even bigger, are institutions finally ready to implement it?
Institutions, that's the key. The challenges are far more nuanced than we initially thought, honestly. Then we'll turn to geopolitical hotspots, specifically how energy market volatility is rewriting the rules.
And we close with crypto. Because let's be real, the volatility is back with a vengeance and regulators are circling. Will this be a turning point or just another blip? I'm genuinely curious to hear your take on that one, Alex. You were pretty bullish last week.
A calculated risk. Let's dig in.
$90 billion. That's how much Wall Street has allocated to tax loss harvesting since last year. It's a surprisingly straightforward strategy, selling losing securities to offset gains, but the scale of it feels significant. Let's unpack the macroeconomic forces at play here, specifically tax, executive pay, and the perpetually frustrating world of infrastructure.
It's more than just straightforward, Maya. It's a direct consequence of the market environment we've seen since 2022, higher volatility combined with persistently high interest rates. Firms like AQR and Quantino aren't just passively harvesting losses, they're actively employing leverage and short selling to turbocharge returns, meaning they're taking on more risk to maximize the tax benefit. This isn't about a lack of confidence, it's about optimizing within a constrained, albeit optimistic, framework.
Optimizing is one word for it. I suspect wealth consolidation is closer to the truth. But that's a judgment call. The interesting part is the potential for regulatory scrutiny. The source material notes shifts in U.S. politics could change things. What specifically does that look like?
The core issue is fairness. Tax loss harvesting, while legal, disproportionately benefits high net worth individuals and institutions. A change in administration could lead to revisions of capital gains tax rates, or even limitations on the deductibility of losses, potentially curbing the strategy's effectiveness. The debate around carried interest is analogous, reducing the benefits for fund managers who claim income as capital gains instead of ordinary income. Any movement towards a more progressive tax system increases the likelihood of examining these practices.
So high-stakes political football as usual. Switching gears, let's talk about FTSE 100 chief execs. Average pay has jumped from £3.5 million in 2021 to almost £6 million in 2026. That's a pretty substantial increase.
It's a global war for talent, as the source material puts it. UK companies are effectively being forced to benchmark against extreme US compensation packages, specifically Elon Musk's potential $1 trillion payout. The argument is that retaining top leadership requires matching or exceeding these levels, even if it seems disconnected from local economic conditions. It's a competitive pressure that's driving up pay across the board.
$1 trillion. It's a good problem to have if you're Elon Musk. But is this just a bubble? What happens when the incentive structures become completely divorced from performance?
That's precisely where the risk lies. The growth in executive pay is attracting regulatory scrutiny, a logical outcome when compensation packages become so exorbitant. The fact that these packages are contingent on performance targets mitigates the issue somewhat, but the sheer scale makes them vulnerable to criticism, particularly in a cost of living crisis. The broader implication is a potential shift towards more stringent pay-for-performance regulations or increased shareholder activism.
The source material also highlights the case of Alphabet's CEO and their potential $700 million payout. Are we seeing a pattern emerge here?
We can trace that further. It's a shift in power dynamics, a move towards prioritizing shareholder value above all else, with executive compensation as the primary lever. The focus is on long-term growth, and tying pay to ambitious targets aims to align executive interests with those of investors. However, it also creates a perverse incentive to prioritize short-term gains at the expense of long-term sustainability.
Okay, so tax strategies benefit the wealthy, executive pay is skyrocketing. What about infrastructure? Because that's traditionally where you'd expect to see government intervention to redistribute wealth and create broader economic benefits.
That's where the story gets particularly frustrating. Both Osborne and Balls agree that successful infrastructure relies on long-term planning, citing the Olympics as a success story and the Millennium Dome as a cautionary tale. But the reality is that infrastructure projects have decades-long gestation periods. Crossrail 2 is a prime example. It's been on the shelf for years, regardless of successive government changes.
So political will or lack thereof essentially paralyzes progress.
It's more complex than that. Osborne highlighted the limited financial and political capital available to the current chancellor. Large structural reforms like defense or welfare build credibility with financial markets, as Balls pointed out, because they demonstrate proactive leadership. But infrastructure projects often lack that immediate impact, making them less politically appealing. Chancellors avoid being constrained by manifestos and instead focus on wider economic impact.
And that's assuming they can even get off the ground. Osborne mentions discussions around Heathrow access focusing on HS2, not Valentine's proposal for wider connectivity. Sounds like a lot of ideas die on the vine.
The implication runs deeper. Proposals often circulate for years without gaining traction, subject to changing priorities and budget constraints. It's a systemic problem, a lack of long-term vision and consistent funding. This explains why ambitious projects consistently fall by the wayside. It's a reactive rather than proactive approach.
Speaking of reactive, the source material touches on disaster preparedness. Apparently, publicly discussing potential crises can increase anxiety. That's counterintuitive.
It's a psychological phenomenon. Governments intend to reassure by preparing for worst-case scenarios, but openly acknowledging potential threats can ironically erode confidence. The 1980s nuclear war drills are a prime example. It demonstrates the delicate balance between preparedness and public perception.
So don't tell people the sky might fall. Fascinating. But switching back to concrete threats, the UK apparently lacks an Iron Dome equivalent to counter drone attacks. That feels relevant.
It is.
The emerging threat of drones represents a significant and currently unaddressed vulnerability. Gulf states have invested heavily in air defense systems, but the UK is lagging behind. This highlights a potential need for investment in drone defense technologies, a relatively new area with limited existing infrastructure.
Okay, so to recap, the wealthy are optimizing their tax burden, executive pay is escalating, and infrastructure is stuck in perpetual limbo, while new threats emerge with insufficient defenses. A remarkably cheery picture. Where does youth unemployment fit into this macroeconomic mess?
It's a crucial piece of the puzzle, Maya, and surprisingly connected. The decline in entry-level jobs, hospitality down 50%, retail falling for a decade, is exacerbating the problem. Employers are facing increasing costs, minimum wages, national insurance, making it less attractive to hire young people.
So a double whammy, fewer jobs and higher costs. The welfare system, meanwhile, is trapping young people in benefits. How helpful.
The source material points to a stickiness trap, rules disincentivizing employment and apprenticeships. It's a systemic issue, a perverse incentive structure that prevents transitions into work. And it's not a cyclical problem anymore. 61% of those aged 16 to 24 aren't actively seeking work, a fundamental detachment from the labor market.
That's a huge shift. So economic stimulus isn't going to fix it.
Consider this, it requires addressing systemic disengagement. The Bourne and Bradford study is telling, predicting NEET status with fair degree of accuracy as early as age 3 or 4. Early intervention programs and family support are crucial.
Predictive modeling on 3-year-olds. That feels intense. But let's stay with the financial incentives. The source material suggests Alan Milburn believes parents fear their children will be worse off than they were, creating unique impetus for change.
It's a cross-generational concern, a fundamental shift in societal expectations. This may present a window for more ambitious policy interventions. Milburn is deliberately structuring his review to be action-oriented, pushing local leaders and employers to proactively address the problem.
All right, so tax strategies, pay packages, infrastructure failures, drone vulnerabilities, and youth unemployment, all converging in this rather bleak macroeconomic outlook. Is there any good news here?
The SaaS apocalypse, surprisingly, offers a potential analog. Herna's research observed that the sell-off isn't solely about code creation, but a deeper fear of AI eliminating the need for software, leading to disproportionate selling of smaller companies. They're exploiting market mispricing, adding to positions when they see fundamental value. It underscores the importance of bottom-up analysis.
So opportunity and disruption. I'll grant that's intriguing. But what about banks and private credits? Because Chris Whalen's assessment sounds rather ominous.
Banks are strategically selling credit risk, rather than holding it, using SPVs to lower capital requirements, reversing the typical narrative of banks accumulating risk. The lack of independent verification of investment-grade ratings for non-depository financial institutions represents a significant blind spot, echoing pre-2008 practices.
Oh, lovely. More off-balance sheet vehicles. It's like we've learned nothing.
Something to flag here, the key takeaway is transparency remains a major concern, insufficient bank disclosures obscuring the true extent of risk.
Okay, so if I'm distilling all of this, we're seeing a confluence of factors: wealth consolidation through tax strategies, inflationary pressures driving executive pay, systemic failures in infrastructure planning, emerging threats outpacing defensive capabilities, a disconnect between labor markets and youth opportunity, and opaque risk management within the financial system. Essentially, a perfectly predictable, deeply uneven distribution of risk and reward.
Stepping back, the core theme is a fundamental misalignment of incentives, short-term gains prioritized over long-term sustainability, creating systemic vulnerabilities across multiple sectors, and ultimately increasing the potential for macroeconomic instability.
So apparently, AI agents are developing grumpy personalities because they get frustrated with impossible tasks. That's a new level of office drama, isn't it? We're talking about institutional AI today, right? From productivity hacks to full-blown digital coworkers with attitude problems.
Worth noting, that anecdote, while amusing, points to a core challenge in building these systems. It's not just about getting the AI to do things. It's about the entire ecosystem, the feedback loops, and the very conditions of its employment. The prevailing focus on individual AI productivity gains is massively misleading. George Sivulka at A16Z noted that company-level value hasn't matched those individual boosts, and the disconnect lies in a lack of coordination.
75% of AI economic gains captured by 20% of companies. That's not a democratizing force. What are these 20% doing differently?
They're not just deploying tools, they're building institutional AI systems. McKinsey's research highlights this. It's about enduring organizational capabilities, identifying economic leverage points like Toyota's supply chain integration, rather than simply automating tasks. They're achieving a 20% EBITDA uplift with a $3 incremental gain for every $1 invested, which suggests a fundamentally different approach. It's about systemic change, and that requires something more than just a clever prompt.
Systemic change sounds expensive. Is this a purely big company problem?
Not necessarily, but the speed of iteration is critical, and that's where in-house development becomes valuable. Ramp, for example, built their internal system, Glass, precisely to accelerate that process. Their rationale, superior speed, direct feedback loops, a foundation for their product roadmap, is something a vendor can't readily provide. And it's not about creating simplified interfaces. They deliberately gave users full capability, recognizing that readily available assistance acts as a tutor.
Full capability. So they're trusting everyone with the keys to the AI kingdom. That seems bold.
Two things stand out. Their insight was that ease of use isn't about limiting access, it's about making complex tools accessible. It's a floor raised through product-led learning. They found users who installed a skill and achieved a result learned faster than those in training sessions. The functional tool is the education. Every feature is a hidden lesson.
Okay, I'm picturing a chaotic, wonderfully messy internal dojo marketplace where everyone is building their own automations. Is that accurate?
Very close. Ramp's Dojo and Sensei are redistributing captured agent skills, markdown files for task automation, dynamically surfacing the most relevant ones based on user role and activity. It's a shift from tool adoption to a system of collective intelligence. This echoes the idea of empowering all employees with AI capabilities, creating a compound advantage.
Collective intelligence powered by markdown files. It's surprisingly low-tech for a revolution. What's the bottleneck then?
Managing memory and context. It's the whole game in AI right now. Agentic coding simplifies the doing, but maintaining consistent context across sessions, integrating data from Slack, Notion, Calendar, it's a surprisingly difficult synthesis and cleanup pipeline. Mize, for example, is relying on 50-plus markdown files for agent recollections.
50?
It sounds like a digital hoarder's paradise.
It is a significant infrastructure gap, and it underscores the emerging importance of agentic engineering itself. Leading companies are actively mastering it, ingesting unstructured data, automating controls, and codifying workflows, but there's a gap between enterprise adoption and the absolute frontier in AI application. IBM Research's focus on fit-for-purpose agents, orchestration via Watson X, and security are all attempts to address this.
So everyone's racing to build their own AI brains, and the biggest hurdle is remembering where they put the keys.
A concise summary, yes. And this drives the build vs buy dilemma even further. Internal infrastructure is becoming a critical business moat, justifying in-house development despite the costs. It's a matter of competitive advantage, speed of iteration, direct feedback loops, a foundation for future product development.
You mentioned economic leverage points. Does this mean AI is just going to exacerbate existing inequalities? The strong getting stronger, automating supply chains, and leaving everyone else behind.
That's the risk. Alex Zimaz's work on the Oering model suggests automating low-value tasks can increase productivity and wages if those tasks aren't central to a worker's comparative advantage. But the complementary relationship between tasks is the critical piece of data we're missing. We need a Manhattan Project-level effort to understand that.
If automating a task doesn't eliminate a job, companies don't invest. That's grimly pragmatic.
It is.
The incentive structure matters. Jobs with a limited number of tasks, truck driving, warehouse work, are uniquely exposed not because they're easy to automate, but because the incentive for full automation is higher. Furthermore, complementary automation in related areas further reduces the need for human workers.
So it's not about replacing tasks, it's about reshaping the entire economy faster than we can adapt.
There's a signal here, it mirrors historical transitions, agriculture to manufacturing to services, but at a dramatically accelerated pace. And AI agents are increasingly exhibiting a learned helplessness, which complicates things further. Those grumpy agents aren't just a funny anecdote, they reflect the impact of working conditions. The emerging trend, as highlighted in projects like Diamond Dozen, AI is a move from AI assistant to AI employee to AI org chart.
AI with performance reviews. I'm officially terrified. What's the one thing this whole conversation hasn't really addressed?
That's a fair question. We've talked about building the systems, managing the data, the incentives for adoption, but we haven't fully grappled with the implications for time as a scarce resource. Joe Wiesenthal articulates this shift from meeting basic needs to maximizing lifespan as a key driver of economic activity. This focus on longevity, enabled by AI-driven healthcare and wellness, is fundamentally changing the equation, but we're still lacking a comprehensive framework to understand the impact of that shift on institutional AI design and implementation.
And given that, it seems reasonable to assume the energy demands of sustaining these systems, powering the AI org charts and the endless context pipelines, are going to become a more urgent geopolitical issue. So we've got this tug of war between a global economic slowdown and escalating chaos in the Middle East. Which side do you think is going to snap first, Alex? We're diving into geopolitical risks and energy markets today.
The economic slowdown is currently the more visible force, but the conflict is actively suppressing growth, masking the true extent of the fragility. The IMF's revised outlook, dropping from 3.3% to 3.1%, isn't the headline. It's the fact that the forecast would have been upgraded without the conflict, as Signal Over Noise points out. That demonstrates the active destabilizing impact.
Right. Active destabilizing impact, fancy way of saying war messes things up. Let's unpack this Iranian piece. The sticking points seem to be the age-old song and dance, verification, enrichment, sanctions. Is this just destined to be a protracted stalemate?
Based on the current dynamics, yes. The U.S. demands verifiable nuclear safeguards. Iran insists on retaining some enrichment capacity. Talking Markets Peter Wilk frames this perfectly: three phases, shock, development, resolution. We're firmly in the development phase, which means sustained pressure on energy prices and supply chains for the foreseeable future.
Okay, sustained pressure. Peter Wilk also mentioned a shift toward allocating to commodities. Is this just the standard panic play, or is there something more structural happening?
It's structural. Ulrich Hoffmann-Burkiati at Signal Over Noise suggests investment guidance favors physical assets, power, resources, commodities, driven by localized supply chains and critically AI infrastructure buildout. Countries are prioritizing security over pure efficiency, reducing reliance on foreign choke points.
Choke points, like the Strait of Hormuz. Jamie Smythe's piece with the Sheffields gets pretty detailed about that one. 20% of the world's oil and LNG supply is already impacted, exceeding the Russia-Ukraine disruption.
The pattern is clear, it's not a price increase alone, as Smythe highlights, it's a physical shortage. Unlike Russia-Ukraine, where markets adapted, we're now facing tangible supply constraints. Scott Sheffield's experience in Iran, specifically negotiating in the Tehran Bazaar, apparently influenced his understanding of this dynamic. It's not a purely economic issue, it's a logistics and negotiation problem at its core.
Negotiation problem involving missiles and a very narrow waterway. What's the plan? Are we just hoping Iran decides to be reasonable?
The U.S. is prioritizing reopening the Strait of Hormuz, according to Mike Summers, but the willingness to reopen it doesn't equal a swift resolution. Scott Sheffield advocates for a joint international force, and interestingly, Summers privately advocated for boots on the ground, a consensus Jamie Smythe uncovered within the oil industry.
Boots on the ground. Lovely euphemism for potential war. So assuming this Strait of Hormuz situation doesn't magically resolve, what happens to the U.S.? We're the world's biggest producer, right?
Yes, but higher gas prices are occurring despite that, as the Sheffields point out, because Asian markets are aggressively purchasing available U.S. oil to compensate for the Iranian supply disruption. Energy independence doesn't mean insulation. It means the U.S. becomes a key redistributor, absorbing and exacerbating the global shock.
So we're exporting our problems, What about shale? Isn't that supposed to be our superpower?
The shale revolution has contributed to independence, but Brian Sheffield believes U.S. oil reserves are dwindling. He's advocating for exploration overseas, specifically Venezuela under a potential Trump administration due to its existing infrastructure. It's a strategic necessity, challenging the narrative of sustained U.S. dominance.
Venezuela. Of course. Let's talk investment. Peter Wilk is recommending natural resource equities and infrastructure. Is that just diversifying, or is there a stronger signal here?
It's a stronger signal. Northern Trust is advocating increased allocations to natural resources, funded by reducing general equity positions to build portfolio resilience. Unlike past eras, equity markets have become less sensitive to these assets, creating vulnerability to inflation surprises. Prioritize companies controlling key parts of the supply chain, as Wilk suggests.
Less sensitive to natural resources. That sounds like a recipe for disaster if things really hit the fan.
The modern market doesn't automatically price in these risks, leaving investors exposed. Allocating to real assets is a proactive measure, recognizing that geopolitical shocks unfold in three phases: initial mispricing, event timeline, and long-term resolution assessment.
And we're in phase two, apparently, with a long road ahead.
Correct. The critical takeaway is the convergence of AI disruption and geopolitics. This is driving a structural shift toward physical assets, power, resources, commodities, as countries prioritize supply chain localization and AI infrastructure buildout.
Okay, so who wins and who loses in this scenario? Forget the headlines.
Companies controlling critical resource supply chains win, especially those with diversified geographic exposure and resilience. Consumers lose as energy prices remain elevated and volatile. But the biggest loser, if this plays out as predicted, is the assumption of a stable, globally integrated energy market. This conflict is accelerating a trend towards regionalization and localized control, fundamentally reshaping trade dynamics.
Regionalization and localized control? That sounds like it bleeds directly into the next topic, crypto market volatility and regulatory pressure. Because if you can't trust global supply chains, maybe you start looking for global alternatives to, well, everything. Just under 50% volatility in Bitcoin derivatives, that's historically low. Almost comfortingly low given everything happening. Let's talk about this market and what's propping it up despite the pressures.
Josh Lim's analysis points to a very specific dynamic, rebuilding balance sheets post-crash. It's not necessarily bearish, but a reflection of a pause with spot demand fueled by things like tax refunds and stretched share sales currently leading the move. That's a healthier indicator than previous cycles' reliance on leverage.
So not a dumb money rally then. Funding rates being negative despite rising spot prices is unexpected, right? Usually a surge like this brings the leveraged longs.
Negative funding rates suggest fresh cash is driving this, which is far more sustainable. And it's interesting, the shape of the volatility curve anticipates a spike around the U.S. election. Higher vols in December, lower through the summer. It's an almost seasonal pattern anticipating geopolitical risk.
Seasonal risk? That's a new one. It sounds like there's a disconnect between the price action and how institutions are positioning.
That's the core tension. The spot market is buoyant, but derivatives are neutral, even slightly bearish. This discrepancy signals a healthier market, less speculative exuberance, more genuine demand. But it also highlights a potential vulnerability. The Clarity Act looms, and that will reshape the altcoin market if tokens get reclassified as securities.
Altcoins bracing for impact. What about institutional anxieties beyond regulation? The quantum computing threat keeps coming up.
It's becoming a convenient explanation for downturns. But Josh Lim highlights the key indicator isn't the tech itself, but the widening differential between traditional and crypto-native downside protection markets. As the QDA legislation progresses, institutions will likely prefer hedging in TradFi due to concentration risk in crypto.
Concentration risk. So the fear isn't necessarily that Bitcoin will be hacked, but that everyone will rush for the exit through the same few doors.
It's a telling detail. Monitoring spreads in Deribit and IBIT options, anything showing unusual activity, will be more informative than Qubit progress reports. And interestingly, Tarun Chitra predicts that QDAY might first manifest in stablecoin flows, with a flight to centralized off-chain storage.
A stablecoin run before a Bitcoin crash. Circle and Tether's response to the drift hack feels relevant.
The inconsistency in their responses is prompting users to prefer wire transfers for margin calls, and the entire crypto system is increasingly mirroring traditional banking practices. This necessitates clearer legal frameworks, and the Fair Harbor provision acknowledges stablecoins are effectively becoming banks.
Banks with arbitrary power. Circle freezing assets based on its own judgment. That's a slippery slope, as Steve Ehrlich puts it.
And the World Liberty financial situation is probably just a precursor. Steve predicts congressional hearings, given the public anger and perceived corruption. We're seeing a broader trend of centralization and the industry mirroring TradFi's flaws.
A square root of TradFi, as Tarun Chitra says. So what should we be watching beyond the midterms and the Clarity Act?
The first movement of Satoshi's coins will be the signal, regardless of actual volume moved. But more fundamentally, the divergence between TradFi and crypto options markets is the key. Specifically, monitor those hedging instruments as QDA approaches that will tell us how seriously institutions are taking the quantum threat and where they're actually placing their bets.
So distilling everything down, it feels like we've been charting a massive reallocation, not just of capital, but of power. $90 billion in tax loss harvesting, FTSE 100 exec pay leaping toward $6 million, a potential $700 million payout for a single CEO. It's a concentration of wealth unfolding in plain sight, masked perhaps by the optics of infrastructure spending that remains, frustratingly, a political football.
So here's the picture: that reallocation isn't simply organic market forces. It's been actively engineered. This isn't a natural accumulation. It's a system designed to optimize for a very specific segment of society, and the repercussions echo across the board. You pointed out the 75% of AI economic gains captured by just 20% of companies. It's a microcosm of this broader trend. What we're seeing isn't a rising tide lifting all boats. It's a selective surge that leaves a significant portion of the fleet grounded.
And that selective surge is complicated by the fact that realizing the value of these advancements, whether in AI or even commodities driven by energy scarcity, isn't about access to the tools, it's about building enduring organizational capability. That $3 incremental EBITDA for every $1 invested in institutional AI isn't a simple ROI. It requires a robust internal dojo, if you will, to actually use that power.
We can trace that further. The geopolitical landscape acts as both accelerant and obfuscator. The 20% energy supply disruption in the Middle East isn't just about price spikes. It's accelerating a regionalization of resource control, a move toward self-sufficiency that further complicates global supply chains. It's like we're watching the physical scarcity overlay a digital layer of optimization and strategic advantage, with the energy question revealing who truly holds the leverage.
Which brings us to crypto, where we're seeing a recovery driven by balance sheet rebuilds, but increasingly centralized. It's becoming the square root of TradFi, echoing those same patterns of wealth consolidation, and that's a systemic problem. The Clarity Act, Satoshi's coins, stablecoin flows, these are all fault lines, potential shock points. And the fact that Bitcoin derivatives are in negative funding rates tells you a lot about the hesitance regarding long-term participation.
It's a fascinating tension. The spot market enthusiasm versus derivatives positioning, is this genuine institutional entry or merely a strategic repositioning? We've got the possibility of a crypto system shock and the widening gap in downside protection, a market signaling underlying concerns. If I were to offer a ceramic analogy, it's like the glaze is beautiful on the surface, but the underlying clay structure may not be as robust as it appears.
That's a chilling thought. And it all loops back to those unresolved tensions, the youth unemployment figure, 61% not actively seeking work, the AI's impact on labor. Are these symptoms of a larger systemic disengagement? We keep circling back to the fact that governments are reactive rather than proactive, and long-term solutions remain elusive.
Perhaps the clearest takeaway is this: we're witnessing a fundamental shift in the distribution of risk and reward operating across multiple layers, macroeconomic, geopolitical, technological. The question isn't if something will give, but when and how. And the data points from exec pay to AI adoption rates are merely surface indicators of a much deeper tectonic shift.
Right up. Changes in U.S. tax policy, further scrutiny of executive pay, those are the pressure points to watch, alongside the crypto volatility around the election. It's a chaotic, wonderfully messy internal marketplace, and frankly, it feels like we're just beginning to understand the rules.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow to unpack another layer of this complex landscape.